keep it alive through these lines I write. I keep it live cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling when you're feeling in flare. They can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch a scenario. My stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah. Just nod your head with it, so explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it, no scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool, hear my heartbeat beating to the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so, no overdose cause it's dope. Yo man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow, down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd know we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock, like I told you. I'm doing this for dreams we pursuing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio Show. Once again, with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV. Thank you all for tuning in and welcome back. I'm very happy to be back with you. Hopefully, everybody enjoyed their long holiday weekend, whether you celebrate Christmas or whatever it is you do. Hopefully you spend it with some good friends and family. We all know the holiday itself has been more or less hijacked by corporate America to get you to trick you into spending a bunch of your money on a bunch of crap that you many times don't even need. But anyway, I definitely took the time to spend with some people I care about and do that kind of thing, and you know, that's what these holidays have become. We spent a little time talking about that on the last show. So you go back, make sure you check out all of our shows, because you know, we talk about all kinds of topics, and you know, we talk about future things that are happening in the future. We predict many things on this show, or we talk about, you know, things that are in development, things that are stories that are developing, international news, geopolitics. So you can't catch it all in one show. You listen to one show and you may or may not catch the entire gist of what we're talking about, because we're talking about this stuff over the span of months and years and things like that here on UCY.TV. And we've been on here, DB, how long have we been on this show? Almost 3 years now?
It's got to be, yeah.
I'm joined by my longtime co-host here on Anti-Media Radio, DB Schwartz. Man, how you been?
Good, dude. Good. You know, just to start the show off, in the words of the queen over there, you know, enjoy your final Christmas.
What queen are you talking about?
The Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth. She did a Freudian slip and said, enjoy your final Christmas.
Interesting, interesting. All hail the queen, right? No, I'm just kidding. anyway, yeah, man, we've been going at it here for 3 years, and, you know, we were a little bit rough around the edges when we first started, and how I guess we still are now. But, you know, we've been plugging away at this radio thing and really just letting our, you know, speaking our minds and stuff and kind of going at this world chessboard, I guess you can call it, for a while now. And you know, I guess we've made some pretty accurate predictions in the past, and I like to think that we're continuing to make some relatively accurate predictions. Of course, everyone knows that I've been saying that the Republican nomination is going to go to Rubio. Of course, that's not looking very likely at this moment in time, but you know, you never know what's going to happen. I really don't think it's going to be Trump. But I guess you never know. I guess we're going to have to wait and see what the plan is and how it's going to play out. What we do know is that things don't just happen when it comes to U.S. politics. Most of the stuff is more or less planned out, and most of the candidates are
kind of hand-chosen or hand-groomed by the powers that be, the establishment, whatever you want to call them, the deep state, whatever it is that we want to call these guys in charge of things. There's no denying that there are a handful of players that are calling the shots and financing.
And they do it in plain sight, Nick. That's the funniest part about it. People always go conspiracy theory, tinfoil hat, blah, blah, blah. Well, for the domestic front, it's the Electoral College, and then for everything else, it's the Center for Foreign Relations, or the CFR, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, man, and then they get funded by the Bank of Settlements in Switzerland, and that's it. That's the trifecta.
Yeah, and, you know, Hillary Clinton, or the presumptive Democratic nominee, which is what she's being called, she's spoken in front of the Council on Foreign Relations plenty of times. She's rubbed elbows with Henry Kissinger and all these oligarchs and chess players, whatever, you know, the kind of guys that engineer genocides and things like that. I mean, man, these horrible, horrible people that these people who purport to be our representatives rub elbows with on a regular basis. Brzezinski, you know, all these guys, you know. Anyway, getting on with the show here, we got plenty to talk about. Like I said, hopefully everyone enjoyed the long weekend. I know I did. The show on Wednesday, you know, the last day before the holiday started kicking in there, I think it was a great one. Hopefully everyone can go back on UCYTV's YouTube channel and find that show and all of the other shows. And also check out the other great hosts here on UCY, because there's not just us on Anti-Media Radio going 5 days a week at 8 p.m. Pacific, 11 p.m. Eastern. We do that, but there's also all these other awesome hosts on here talking from all these different perspectives, and you can hear all these other, you know, angles and other journalists out there talking about stuff that matters to you and to them, and, you know, all kinds of different things. We're also joined tonight by our special guest, Jake Anderson. What's up, Jake?
Not much, Nick. Still snowed in here. I got a state of emergency here in New Mexico, actually, from the gargantuan pile of God's tears, frozen God's tears that were dumped down upon us. But I'm pretty good other than that. A little pretty bummed out today at the news of the, you know, grand jury not indicting the police officers that murdered Tamir Rice. And I presume there's quite a few actions going on tonight. I'd love it. I'd love to hear an update of anything going on. Hopefully it, I guess, hopefully it stays peaceful. I don't know. I mean, God, at some point, no justice, no peace. That's what they say, right? Hello?
I guess we're going to have to wait and see how it plays out in Cleveland, because, you know, this Tamir Rice decision by the grand jury, it's pretty egregious, I guess, is the least I can say about it. Those not familiar with the Tamir Rice story, he's a 12-year-old boy that was gunned down by the cops in Cleveland because he had a toy gun or a BB gun or, you know, a fake gun of sorts. And he was sitting in a park. The video is there. You can see the surveillance video. We don't know what exactly happened. It's hearsay. It's he says, she said. No, there's a video there. You can see exactly what happened. And what happened in this case is there was a kid sitting at a bench. He had a toy gun. Somebody called the cops on him. The cops drove their car right into the park, onto the grass, literally a few feet away from the kid, got out of the car and immediately shot him down. It was a matter of like 2 or 3 seconds when they pulled up, got out of the car and shot the kid. There was no 5 second, 10 second negotiation. There was no, hey kid, put the gun down. There was none of that. It was just like, hey, they pulled up and they shot him, and that was it. And he was a 12-year-old boy, and he lost his life because he had a toy gun. And it just kind of goes to show how trigger-happy these cops are.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe it's even illegal in Ohio to have to carry a weapon if you have a permit, right? So there's no immediate reason for the cops to immediately be threatened by this guy, except for call of the guy who reported it, saying a guy was waving a gun around, but the guy also said it looked like a toy, you know. So there's just almost no, just, I mean, it's just unbelievable going to indict them and put this in front of a jury. I mean, it's just, they're once again just circumventing what disgusting frail skeleton of a justice system we have working for us here. And they've done three investigations into this now, and no surprise, it ends with no indictment. And what did the guy say? Prosecutor Timothy McGinty said that the officer's conduct represented a perfect storm of errors, but did not constitute criminal conduct. Whatever. Go to hell.
And acted reasonably. And we're joined also by tonight on the call by Claire Bernish. And she's actually in Ohio, and I think Claire can probably provide us a little bit more insight into this story.
Yeah, please.
I'm not sure that I can. I covered it earlier. In June, a Cleveland municipal judge actually watched the video when he was trying to decide about charges for the officer involved, and he said that he was thunderstruck by how quickly the event turned deadly. I mean, that's a quote. This judge was, like, dumbfounded at what he saw, and said there were grounds to charge the cop with murder, but then, you know, it was up to the, I think it was up to the DA, or no, it was up to the prosecutor, Cuyahoga County prosecutor, to decide if he was going to be charged with murder or not, and this whole case is just absurd. I mean, when the officer rolled up on the scene, he jumped out of his car so quickly, it was still rolling at the time he shot Tamira, so there's just no question about it being murder. But.
Yeah, it was like a split second. And like I said, the video's out there. You can go on the article that Jake wrote today. It was just a quick article about the grand jury ruling. You know, we included a short video there about, you know, that showed the incident play out. And it was just a split second. Like Jake was saying, I mean, I don't know the exact laws in Ohio, but I'm sure they have carry permits and, you know,
it's a pretty liberal gun, like liberal laws with guns in this state.
Yeah, so, you know, you can carry guns in Ohio. They didn't even like try to, hey dude, where's your permit, let's see the permit for the gun, let's see the ID. None of that even happened. It was like they roll up, the guy jumps out and shoots the kid, and that was it.
Within 2 seconds of arriving on scene. And the thing is, accounting for it, he didn't give him time not only to comply, he couldn't have heard anything in less than 2 seconds. He couldn't have heard the cop possibly, even if the cop did, you know, says that he said something like, drop your weapon. He couldn't have possibly even responded to that if the cop even had time to say that.
Yeah, man.
But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, does it? Because the cops can literally have impunity to kill anyone they want. All they have to do is claim some modicum of self-defense, some legalese speak that the police union will use to say that they acted in some reasonable manner. I mean, it's just sickening, man. It's sickening.
It really is, man. And, you know, here in the Southwest, where we're at, you know, growing up in the, you know, early and mid 90s and stuff, when I was a kid, there was like ice cream men that would drive by in trucks, and they'd sell ice cream and Mexican candy and toys and crap like that. When I was a kid, you know, me and my brothers would buy the toy guns from the ice cream man, and they legitimately look like 9mm pistols, but they had like an orange tip on them. But in order for them, for us as kids, we're like, oh, we want them to be more realistic. We'd get like Sharpies and we'd paint over the orange part on the end and make it all black, and it would look, you know, it legitimately look like a 9mm pistol, you know, and they'd shoot these little rubber bullets and stuff, But, you know, back then, in those days, we never got harassed by the cops. It was never like, oh, my God, the kid's got a gun. Like, and the neighbors, you know, people weren't, like, calling the cops on you and stuff because they're so damn scared of each other. Now, keep in mind, this is, like, pre-9/11, before all this fear-mongering and all this crap kicked in. And it's like, oh, everyone's a suspect until proven innocent. back then it was like, oh, they're just kids being kids, and yeah, they're gonna play with toy guns and even BB guns, and they're gonna shoot each other and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and they're gonna have fun and do their thing. But now it's like, oh my God, there's a kid with a gun. Who knows if it's real or not? You know, call the cops anyway. You know, not even, don't even wait to find out. I remember I think it was like 2 or 3 years ago, my little brother was out at the park with his friends playing with the airsoft gun. Airsoft guns, you know, they look like real guns. They shoot these little plastic pellets. And, you know, kids play them. It's kind of like paintball, and you play airsoft guns and stuff. And they were at the park, a local park here in Chula Vista, and my little brother and three of his friends were out there playing. And I shit you not, a police helicopter shows up, and like a bunch of cops roll up on them because they're playing airsoft guns, and they're like, oh, we were worried that you guys were, you know, had real guns and stuff. So, you know, and they rolled up on them, and they just like sent them packing, like, hey, just go home, like, you can't play here no more. But, you know, it's very symptomatic of the kind of paranoid atmosphere that has developed here post 9/11 with all the fear mongering and everybody skeptical of their neighbors and everyone's afraid of everyone else. And, you know, it all plays into this divide and conquer type of mindset that is now dominating the entire culture of the United States. And it's really sad, you know, and I guess the police state is kind of an answer to that. You know, we got to look back and wonder, like, well, how in the hell did these cops get so militarized? How did they get so violent? How did we allow this to happen? Well, there it is. You know, we allowed ourselves to get propagandized by the fear-mongering post 9/11, and now they kind of, this militarization kind of snuck in there under our noses. Nobody really realized it until just the last few years, when the YouTube generation started really posting these cop videos online, and it's like, holy shit, people are getting gunned down left and right now. You know, and now you know, thankfully, I guess. On one hand, thankfully, we have this technology where we can kind of expose this stuff. Unfortunately, it's like, damn, now we're starting to realize we have a police state on our hands here, and we got to do something about it. And I think that's why there's so many protests and, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and all the police accountability activism that's been going on the last 2 years has really stepped up. And so I guess we're going to see what happens in Cleveland. I mean, I've seen many, many people speculating online that there may be riots going on in Cleveland, and I don't blame them, you know. And after something this blatant happening, a 12-year-old boy gunned down for having a toy gun, yeah, that's something that I would expect to see riots afterwards. I'm not saying that that's what I want to happen, but wouldn't be surprised if it did, because at some point you get so frustrated with what's going on, you know, that the only outlet is that.
And that's most of my family grew up in Cleveland, and that's a very hard hit, economically sunk area of the country where the white flight really took place. And they're all out in the suburbs, and the inner cities are, you know, very, very decrepit. And yeah, man, I can imagine that as a tinder keg and it's ready to blow.
Very well could be, man. Claire, what do you think?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, that town is kind of, it has like a reputation in Ohio for being kind of a rough place. And, you know, I just can't imagine that there wouldn't be some sort of rioting or massive protest after this. I mean, this is completely like absurd in my opinion. And I think it would be perfectly justified for almost anything to happen now.
You know, we're going to have to wait and see what happens. It's going to be a long night, I'm guessing, in Cleveland. I hope everyone stays safe, and I hope everyone's all right.
Well, we're not going to hear any kind of, hopefully we'll get some live stream legitimate reporting going on, because I guarantee you if I go to CNN right now, it's going to be some bullshit about... Oh no, it's about the affluenza teen in custody. All right. Never mind.
Well, they're probably covering Trump. I think CNN covered Trump like 150 times in the last 2 weeks. And
Oh no, look, CNN's doing a look back at 2015. It's called LOL, the year in laughter. Oh, that's important. Okay, cool. All right. Well, CNN,
it was such a funny year, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a funny year. All these people died and TPP is going through, and God, I'm just thankful that we have CNN to give us this year in review, the LOL year in laughter.
I was seeing some other pretty ironic stuff. I'm trying to remember what side it was on, but they were chalking up peace in Syria as one of 2015's major victories. And it was like, wait, peace in Syria? Wait, what are you guys talking about? Syria is basically the most violent place in the entire world right now. It's not a peaceful place. It's got thousands of people dying a day. There's millions of people displaced. And it's like, oh yeah, this is one of our major wins this year is, you know, Syria, you know, chalk that up as a victory. It's like, whoa.
Hey, could be worse.
I mean, I don't know what universe or what dimension these people are living in. It's over on Politico. And according to the State Department, bringing peace to Syria is a 2015 win. And it's I mean, I don't know if it's sickening or if it's funny or if it's ironic. I really don't know. It's just really bad. It's like, okay, guys, I don't know where you're living, but Syria is not a nice place right now. It's really bad. There's almost 70 countries bombing the place. You've got like dozens of terror groups over there trying vying.
You sure that wasn't satire?
Yeah, no, it was on Politico. It definitely was not meant to be satire. It was kind of satirical. You know, and then also in Syria, you got the Assad government bombing its own people. And, of course, you got all these world powers covertly backing different groups geopolitically to, you know, secure resources and trade routes. And, you know, it's the same old shit that we've been dealing with empires for the last couple thousand years. It's like trade routes and geopolitics and resources. That's what all these empires have been about forever. And yeah, the same exact shit continues on to this day.
And now the North Pole is getting hot. I don't know if a lot of people know because of the melt. It's exposing a huge landmass they didn't know about. And guess what's up there? I don't know, like another 10 Saudi Arabias.
Oh, well, there you go, man. There's going to be – well, there's already that polar –
Sounds like the polar bears need some freedom to me.
Yeah, the polar bears need some democracy, man. I mean, shit, the leader of the polar bears has been oppressing his people, you know, and
yeah, the grizzly bear community is ready to ban him.
Yeah. but no, seriously though, you know, Russia and the US have been kind of vying for territory up there in the polar regions because they've been discovering a bunch of oil up there and stuff. And so that's the next frontier. We know about the whole thing with China over there in the South China Sea with those disputed islands because they found a bunch of resources under there as well. And so all these, you know, all these conflicts and stuff can be traced back for the most part to resources and stuff. And it's really sad that people die in all these wars because a select handful of people want to get rich. You know, and so then, therefore, a bunch of people have to die for it. And, you know, here in the U.S., you know, at least back in the day, back in the days of, like, the Roman Empire, and maybe not, but at least from what I know, it's like, yeah, we're an empire, and we're going to go conquer places. We're going to get rich from conquering shit. You know, and that's kind of – and the Roman people were like, yeah, let's do it. But here in the U.S., it's like, oh, we're bringing them freedom. We're bringing them democracy. We're going to make them – we're saving them from their bad leaders and stuff like that. And, like, that's the new way of selling empire is, like, oh, they trick us into thinking that we're actually doing the right thing instead of saying – being honest and, like, you know what? We're going to go in Iraq. We're going to knock out the government. We're going to take their oil, and we're going to establish our own puppet government. And you know what? Just because. We're doing it because it's going to make us rich. No. They don't tell us that no more. It's like, oh, it's because Saddam Hussein's a bad guy, and, you know, he supports ISIS and – or he supports – oh, sorry, Al-Qaeda. You know, he supports Al-Qaeda and, you know, that kind of thing. So we're going to go save those people. And in the meantime, yeah, we are going to take their oil and sell it to our you know, corporations and stuff like that. But no, what we're really trying to do is, like, bring them democracy and freedom and stuff like that. I mean, the new age of empires is so misleading, and it's such a big lie, you know, and it's so sad that a lot of people buy into it. You know, and I feel like back in the day, the empires were a little more honest, you know, like the British Empire. It's like, dude, we're just going to go conquer these countries. We're going to jack them for all their resources. We're going to subjugate the people. And, you know, that's it because we're better than them. But now it's like, yeah, well, they still believe in the same philosophy, but they tell us a whole different story. You know what I mean? And that is, like, really the thing that really gets me. The thing that bothers me the most is that most people in the United States buy into this shit. Hook, line, and sinker. Like, yep. Yeah, that's what we're doing. We're bringing freedom to Libya and Syria and Iraq and Somalia and Cameroon, I guess, now, apparently. You know, and it's just, to me, it's like, oh, my God, really? You guys buy this shit? Ah, it's just so crazy. But we got a little bit of positive news here coming out of California. And this to me, was the best. I mean, we're at the end of 2015. And for me to say this is the best story of 2015 is pretty big, because there's been a lot of stories out of 2015, right? Apparently, somebody launched a petition, and they're trying to put this on the 2016 ballot in California to get politicians to actually wear the logos of their top 10 political donors, corporate donors. So all these California politicians in the state legislature, it's not going to affect Dianne Feinstein or Nancy Pelosi, unfortunately, but it will affect all California legislators, and I think even including the governor, where they'll actually have to wear the logos of the corporations that pay for all of their financing and that kind of thing. And so, like, you know, if this thing gets on the ballot, I guarantee you it gets voted for. You know what I'm saying? I mean, this is the most hilarious thing ever. What do you guys think of this? Did you see this story?
So in other words, it's Governor Brown brought to you by Huggies.
I just hope they have to wear the racetrack suits that the NASCAR people have to wear. I mean, that would be the. It's obviously an incredible idea. I can't imagine them letting it pass. It's so absurd. I mean, it makes it so palpably absurd.
I love it though, because the politicians are kind of in a catch-22, because they can't really say, I don't want this bill, because then what are they hiding? I mean, they kind of have to. This has to work. I love this.
Yeah, it's going to be really funny, I think. I mean, it's. I mean, I don't know, man. It would definitely be the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. And, like, you know, it would be like Governor Jerry Brown brought to you by Big Fracking. You know what I mean? And it would just be the funniest thing. But, you know, a lot of these politicians out there, they don't think it's very funny. They're actually taking kind of a offense to this thing, because it's according to Assembly Member Rocky Chavez, to have everyone decked out like race car drivers, and I'm quoting here, to have everyone decked out like race car drivers would be a circus element that wouldn't really benefit the public, unquote. I mean, and someone responded to what he said regarding the whole circus element is what he was criticizing. You know what's this is a quote too. You know what's a circus? That politicians can openly take money from corporations and unions and have no accountability afterwards. It's a complete joke. If Mr. Chavez doesn't like this, I have a brilliant solution for him. Stop taking money. Problem solved. Circus avoided. There you go. You know, if you know, these politicians are going to be visibly mad if this actually, you know, they need what was it? They need around 365,000 signatures to get this thing on the ballot, which actually isn't that much, because in California we got over 30 million people. So, you know, we're talking about like less than – you're talking about like 1% of the population having to sign this petition to put this thing on the ballot. Once it gets on the ballot – I mean, I can't name one Californian that would say, no, this is a bad idea. I think everyone would support this. If we get this thing on the ballot, California politicians after 2016 are going to have to start wearing their corporate sponsors on their sleeves. This is going to be the funniest thing I've ever seen, and this very well could change the way that these politicians act and the money they accept. Because who wants to be walking around with a private prison logo on his sleeve, or Big Fracking, or the oil companies, or AT&T, or Verizon, whatever. All these corporations that are pretty much hated by everyone. Do these politicians really want to walk around with that shit on their clothing and be giving speeches and it be showing? I mean, who would take them seriously? And, like, this is the thing. Is like, as the person I was quoting said, you know, these politicians are mad because they think it's going to turn into a circus-like atmosphere. It's like they've already created a circus atmosphere by accepting all this money and turning this quote-unquote democracy into a huge joke, you know?
I think they look sillier in suits considering what they do and all the hypocrisy that they, you know, affect on the populace compared to what they would look like in NASCAR suits with their sponsors on their sleeves.
I think they should have to have it branded onto them with those burning iron.
There you go. Or tattooed on their foreheads. That'd be good.
What, are they going to throw a loophole in where they can wear like a full helmet or something too?
The politicians are going to be wearing burkas after this thing goes in, and they're not going to be showing any skin. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, this thing is funny. Check it out on the anti-media. The title of the article is called California Politicians Could Soon Be Forced to Wear Logos of Top Corporate Donors. And you can find the petition there in the article. We link to the petition. Let me find the name of the the name of the organization that's putting this thing together is called California Is Not For Sale, which is a fitting title. Check them out. I mean, they need all the support they can get. They don't have that much momentum yet, but come on, this is a great idea. Yeah, I mean, this is a beautiful idea. I mean, they need all the support they can get. So according to the organization, they are preparing to receive title and summary in the next week and will then begin collecting signatures in California. So this is actually happening, and next week it'll become reality. So this petition is going to go out, and it only needs 365,000 people. I mean, shit, San Diego alone, where we're at, has more people than that. So I think it's going to happen. This is going to be great. I'm a huge advocate. And, you know, I'm not a huge voter, but shit, you know, this is what's going to happen, hopefully. Anyway, we got some other good news here. Being that we're coming up on the new year, I don't want to go too into the negative here. Of course, there's all this stuff going on with Tamir Rice and geopolitics. But Jake, you had another article today about Costa Rica and the fact that they went through 2015 and used 99% renewable energy. In fact, they went something like 285 days in 2015 using no fossil fuels. I mean, this is huge. These are the solutions that we need, because as we mentioned earlier in the show, you know, most of these wars, most of these empire, most of this conflict going on all around the world, it's all based on resources and stuff like that. Well, when we take away the fact that, you know, energy is basically the most sought after resource right now, and for the most part around the world, it's being provided by carbon, you know, based fuels, fossil fuels, and oil and coal and that kind of thing, and that's why these guys are fighting these wars. Well, I think Costa Rica is leading the way not only in just renewable energy and being green, but also in peace. Jake, what can you tell us about this story?
Yeah, Costa Rica is awesome. Really want to move anywhere that's not America, but Costa Rica would be a good start. Paraguay, Colombia, Brazil, a bunch of other Latin American countries are really leading the way in hydroelectric and renewable energy. But Costa Rica, they basically there was at some point, I think it was 75 straight days or something. It culminated with a 200, like you said, 285 days of the year that they were completely fossil fuel free. Now, of course, their transportation system, of course, uses fossil fuels, but we're talking about in terms of powering the country, powering utilities and industry and whatnot. I'm not sure how transportation factors into that, but for all intents and purposes, they achieved a 99% renewable energy mark. 80% of that energy is coming from hydroelectric plants, and they have a new one coming online in 2016. It's a $2.3 billion project. So And this was actually a weak year for rainfall for Costa Rica. So there's every reason to believe that 2016 is actually going to be a bigger watershed year. I mean, they're already at 99%. I guess they're going to hit 100, and that's their goal. Their goal is to be, you know, 100% carbon neutral by 2021. Looks like they're easily going to get to that.
I mean, especially with El Nino factoring into this, I wouldn't be surprised if next year they were at like 110%. You know, selling it to neighboring countries at, you know, even.
Yeah, I think that probably would be a good export for them. Is you know, a renewable energy, I don't know, plants, maybe outsource some of their hydroelectric plants to other countries that don't have as easy of a time because of, you know, Costa Rica has a huge river system, and with the rainfall combined, it's just really an ideal spot for that kind of energy production. And yeah, I mean, they stepped up. They said at the beginning of 2015, this is what we're going to do. This is a lot of this information is coming from the Costa Rican Electricity Institute, which is a publicly owned electricity provider. It's the nation's publicly owned electricity provider. And yeah, they're proud of it, and they should be proud of it. It's a huge mark. I mean, it shows that a country can do this. And, you know, there's other countries in Europe and whatnot, you know, countries like, you know, Denmark, Sweden, Scotland, Finland, that are trying other ways to wean themselves off of fossil fuels. And yeah, I mean, at this point, we're so past the point of no return when it comes to kind of changing the world, maybe. But I think we have to create actionable examples of how something can be done for the future, so that when people say, well, this can't be done, you know, biomass, wind, and blah, blah, blah can never do it. Well, no, it can be done. Now, obviously, it's different in the U.S., it's different in China, it's different in India, where you're talking about a whole different ball game of energy demands, but it's possible, so don't say it's not possible.
Definitely, man. And yeah, I mean, of course, this goes well beyond just fossil fuels. It goes beyond greenhouse gases. It's really, to me, the bigger picture here is about peace, you know, and about nations being self-sustaining, where they don't have to go out and overthrow other countries just to get their stuff, you know, get their resources and stuff. And energy is the most sought after resource. With energy, I mean, now we've got so many advanced technologies like 3D printing and things like that, where we don't got to go invade countries just to get their trees and their forests for lumber and stuff like that anymore. You know, mainly now it's about energy and oil and stuff. And if the more the earth, the more the nations around the world and places, countries, communities can kind of get more self-sustaining like Costa Rica is doing, well, the more chances we have of actually seeing peace. You know what I'm saying? This to me is the biggest factor here, and Costa Rica is leading the way. There's lots of other countries that are actually making major strides here. I know we covered on the anti-media recently about how there was a point where, I think it was in Germany, where energy prices actually reached zero for a whole day because there was so much wind that day or something from all the solar turbines they have out there. Where it drove the price of energy down to zero at one point, you know, and so there's plenty of countries out there making strides, but Costa Rica is definitely probably the greatest example right now. But I think the U.S. should be embracing more and more of this kind of stuff because, you know, it's something that we have to do embrace in the future. Otherwise, we're just going to be stuck in the same cycle, the same, you know, empire, conquer, rise, fall, boom, bust, bubble, you know, the same crap that we've been dealing with for a long time, whether it's the British Empire or us or Germany or whatever, all of us, everyone dealt with it. You know, we're going to have to keep dealing with it unless we make some major changes. That's starting to happen finally. DB, what do you think, man? I mean, we always talk about this alternative energy stuff, self-sustainability and things like that. How do you feel about this?
Yeah, man, it's going to eventually just be these huge, you know, conurbations of solar panels out in the middle of nowhere, making power and gridding it in, a la like the Matrix revolutions. And yeah, that'll be the way we make power. And everybody will have, you know, their own solar panels and their little mini wind turbines. And, you know, those will be the main drivers, and we'll supplement for extreme weather with the old fossil fuel way. But I mean, eventually maybe we'll go to thorium reactors for nuclear. We can bury them out in the middle of nowhere too, and they don't need any liquid to cool. So no meltdown really, unless there's the mother of all earthquakes. But yeah, that's the way it's going.
Yeah, dude. You know, the other thing too here is that besides, you know, and as Jake mentioned, a lot of the energy coming from in Costa Rica is from hydroelectric. And many times hydroelectric is kind of it has the same issues that other fuel, you know, other energy systems have right now that we are dealing with currently, is over concentration of control over that resource into a small amount of hands. And I think, I don't know exactly how Costa Rica works, but I think they have like a bunch of like public utilities that kind of control that stuff. But again, when we talk about renewable energies and energy in general, one important principle to remember is that decentralization is key to maintaining our independence and our freedom. If we have 100% renewable energy, great. But if that entire energy grid is just controlled by Google or some corporation like that, well, then we're still in the same kind of tough spot that we're in before, where it's like we're relying on Exxon to provide us with all this oil or whatever. Well, if we're just switching it, okay, well, no longer are we relying on Exxon. Now we're just relying on Google to supply us with all this energy. Well, then we're still having the same problem. Google still has control over our you know, the fate of our energy, you know. And so it's always important to remember the principle of decentralization and self-reliance when it comes to energy. The more that individuals and families and communities can produce their own energy and kind of unplug from the larger grids, well, that gives those communities, those individuals, those families more autonomy over their own, you know, energy needs. And that in turn gives you more freedom to do what you want to do, and less control over, you know, less control of our lives to corporations and governments and things like that, that tend to, you know, that throughout history have tend to abuse their powers, you know. And so we want to, when we talk about this energy revolution, we definitely want to keep the key of decentralization in there to overturn the power control, the control grid, you know. And taking back the energy grid will also take back the control grid and take the power back into the hands of the individuals and things like that. And that's what we need to remember moving forward. And I think one thing to keep in mind, as DB mentioned, is everyone having their own solar panels, their own wind systems and things like that, on your own house or your apartment building or in your community, and whether it's a co-op or it's privately run, or, you know, you and your neighbors all pitch in and there's like a vacant lot and you all put solar panels and you all share the electricity. Things like that is how we like kind of take the power back into our own hands and stop relying on these, you know, mega corporations to provide us with all these services. Because these corporations in many, many ways and most times are just as corrupt as governments, or just as power hungry. And, you know, they're driven purely by profits and, you know, that kind of thing. And so that's always something to keep in mind as we move forward. That being said, I mean, so many other stories out there tonight. Anything in particular you guys want to talk about? Because if not, I'm going to jump right into this whole ISIS-Turkey thing.
Sounds good to me.
All right, cool. So before we do that, we have a... No, never mind. I thought we had a caller on the line. We did, but they hung up. So over the weekend, we published a story on the anti-media about an ISIS commander was killed in Iraq. And on his cell phone, they found some communications between this ISIS commander and Turkish intelligence services. And it more or less goes to show that Turkey has been aiding ISIS. And as we all know, Turkey is a NATO country. NATO, the North Atlantic, blah, blah, blah. I don't even know what it stands for. What I do know is that
shady organization.
There you go. It's a huge military organization that is more or less the enforcement arm of the neo-empire, whether we call it the American Empire, the Western Empire. You know, it's kind of like the American and the British Empire morphed together and created NATO and kind of brought in a bunch of these other countries to help, you know, finance it and do the muscle work. We don't want to confuse anyone out there because NATO is, for the most part, a U.S.-funded and staffed and, you know, all the equipment and stuff is in most ways supplied by the United States. And so Turkey is part of NATO. In fact, I think they're the only Middle Eastern country that is part of NATO. And they're basically helping ISIS. And these guys are supposed to be our friends. They're supposed to be doing our bidding over there. And we're supposed to be relying on them as an ally. And, you know, at the same time, you got Obama out here saying that they're fighting against ISIS and that the reason that we're bombing in Syria and Iraq and stuff is, well, because we're trying to fight ISIS. Well, why is it that our buddies are helping them out? You know, and it's one of those questions that's like, man, what the hell is going on here? You know, and it's kind of hard to nail down and figure out. But a lot of it goes back to what people say about the Rothschilds and stuff. And I know the Rothschild thing is highly stigmatized. And it's a conspiracy theory. But what many people say about the Rothschilds is that they would finance and arm both sides of conflicts. Well, that's exactly what we're starting to see going on in Syria and Iraq, is that NATO is more or less supplying ISIS, helping ISIS and that kind of thing, while at the same time bombing ISIS and fighting against ISIS. And so, you know, you got these NATO members fighting on both sides of this coin. And there's only one group that really wins out of this whole thing on the surface, and that's the military contractors, the guys that make the weapons. So, you know, they're supplying ISIS with all these weapons, and then of course they got all those captured weapons that we gave to Iraq. What was it, like 2,300 Humvees alone that they captured in Mosul? You know, and someone's got to make all this stuff, and there's all these American corporations that make these Humvees and these tanks and these aircraft, these missiles, the bombs, the man pads, the surface-to-air missiles, the anti-aircraft missiles, the anti-tank weaponry. You know, someone's got to make all this stuff. Most of them are being made by American corporations, and those guys are getting really rich right now. They're making a lot of money. In fact, after the terrorist attacks in Paris, the stock prices for a lot of these companies jumped because this terror attack's going to cause them to go bomb a bunch of countries. So then their stock prices went up because people were like, oh, here's our chance to make some profits. But, you know, these guys are making tons of money off this. And then you also have the geopolitical element here where you got the Western interest in toppling the Assyrian government to establish their own trade routes going from the Sunni Gulf states up into Europe, which is mostly directed at kind of containing Russia and cutting Russia out of their European oil trades. And then you got Russia on the other side of the coin that's trying to protect its trade routes and to protect its virtual monopoly on European gas trade and European oil sales and that kind of thing. So you got more or less two of the final major military powers remaining, which is the United States and Russia, vying for trade routes in Syria. And in the end, the people that are really losing here are the Syrian public, you know, which are being killed by the thousands daily whether by their own government or by ISIS or by U.S. airstrikes or by Russian airstrikes. Regardless of who's doing it, you know, the reasons are kind of the same. It's geopolitics, it's oil, it's trade routes, it's pipelines and that kind of thing. And as we mentioned earlier in the show, unfortunately, it's being sold as this kind of humanitarian bombing campaign. And of course, that sounds in itself so Orwellian. It's like, well, wait, we're bombing a country for humanitarian reasons? It's kind of like one of those things like, well, that doesn't make quite that much sense. But when you say it like that, I guess it's okay. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. But no, I mean, it really is. This is what it's about, geopolitics and that kind of thing. And it's really sad. But, you know, Russia came out, what was it, about a month ago, and made a bunch of accusations against Turkey, and that Turkey was buying a bunch of oil from ISIS, and that, you know, Turkey was allowing a bunch of militants to cross the border into Syria. That isn't really disputed. That's kind of already common knowledge. But the fact that they were buying the oil, it was relatively new, and Russia really put the accusation out there. And then they backed it up with a bunch of satellite footage and surveillance footage from the flights they were doing over the region. And the president of Turkey has yet to really disprove any of those accusations, even though he's like, well, show me the proof and I'll step down. But he hasn't really debunked any of it. He just kind of denied it without providing any proof. And so more or less what's starting to settle in here is the fact that Turkey really is doing the bidding of ISIS, and they are playing into, you know, ISIS's agenda here. But because Turkey would benefit greatly from the fall of the Syrian government, because all those pipelines that they're talking about trying to build from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and all these countries in the Sunni Gulf, they would end up having the end destination would be in Turkey, and Turkey would become the distribution hub for all of the fossil fuel resources for Europe. And so Turkey stands to gain a great upper hand over the entire continent of Europe if they're able to topple the Syrian government. And so that's why they're so adamant about supporting ISIS, because ISIS is the only reliable group that's shown the ability to take on the Syrian government. You got a bunch of these so-called moderate rebels that the U.S. Claims to be backing in Syria, but they have shown themselves to be relatively ineffective against the Syrian government. The only group that has shown the ability to fight well is the Kurds, but the Kurds haven't shown much of an interest in fighting against the Syrian government either, because Assad is a secular dictator. And yeah, he is a dictator, but he's relatively secular, and he wasn't the type to persecute the Kurds, and he actually left them relatively autonomous, and so they had, you know, the ability to kind of you know, create their own fate up there in the northern regions of Iraq. And so the Kurds aren't that their top priority isn't to fight the government of Assad, because Assad rules from Damascus, and Damascus is not where the Kurdish region is at. The Kurds' main objective in Syria is to establish their own country. They want to establish an independent Kurdistan throughout Syria and Iraq and Turkey and Iran. And because the poor Kurds, their territory kind of straddles all these countries, and all of these countries have persecuted them, including Turkey, really badly. Turkey treats the Kurds horribly. In fact, they're on a mission right now of almost what some are calling ethnic cleansing.
Well, just all you need to know about Turkey is the Armenian genocide.
Yeah, the Turks have a really bad track record of dealing with minorities. And, you know, the Kurds are being slaughtered left and right in Turkey. They bomb them. I remember when Turkey announced that they were entering the war against ISIS, and it was so Orwellian, like, yeah. And all the media covered it. It's just like, Turkey declares war against ISIS. And then all of their airstrikes were against the Kurds. It's like, wait, I thought they were fighting ISIS. Why are they bombing the Kurds and invading Iraq? And so, you know, it's the Turks, man. I understand that they have such a very strong place, geographically speaking, in the Middle East. You know, they are like the puzzle piece needed to connect all those resources to Europe. And, you know, Europe is, other than the United States, Europe is the biggest consumer of goods, including natural resources, oil and natural gas and plastics and all that stuff. Europe buys the most outside of us. And so that's why Turkey is so important to the geopolitical strategy here. But at what point do the people in NATO, the Western countries that are supposedly out here fighting for democracy and liberating those Syrian people from their oppressive government, at what point do we draw a line and say, look, Turkey is just as bad as the Syrian dictatorship, if not worse? And when do we cut off that allegiance? When do we stop allying with countries that are that egregious when it comes to human rights and democracy and supporting terrorism and that kind of thing? I mean, when do we draw the line? You know, and that's a question that I guess is yet to be answered. I guess in 2016, we may or may not see the answer to that. Because if we don't kick Turkey out of NATO, and if we don't say, hey, you know, enough is enough, we're no longer going to support the actions of Turkey. Well, if we don't do that, well, Turkey may end up dragging us into World War III, and that is a very real prospect. What do you guys think?
I think that's by design, actually. They're going to take the fall, too. I mean, maybe we're seeing the setting of the actual battlefield between East and West right there, and it sucks for those guys to get dragged in and the civilians on the ground. But, you know, if any dictator needed to be overthrown, it'd be the House of Saud and then it'd be Erdogan, right? One and two.
Yeah, and you know, Erdogan, he kind of is able to play off this illusion of democracy over there in Syria. But anyone that pays attention knows that before the election took place, the Erdogan regime kind of went in and took over opposition media. They imprison opposition politicians. They imprison, and if you check out the anti-media tomorrow, the question is being put out there about whether or not they assassinate. Not only do they imprison journalists, but do they even assassinate journalists in Turkey for questioning the regime and questioning the actions of the regime? I mean, this is some very heavy-handed censorship going on in Turkey. And as I mentioned, man, if we're going to talk about us supporting freedom of speech and, you know, the Western way of life, what in the hell are we doing supporting Turkey?
They're unfit to be a member of NATO under our own ethical, you know, charter. So it just goes to show how far we've fallen as a culture ourselves.
Yeah, that's true, man. And our standards have very sunk. You know, we used to go and we used to fight communism and we used to fight against fascism and against the Nazis and against the Japanese. And man, believe me, the Japanese did stuff that was as bad, if not worse, than the Nazis. I mean, just today there was some major news about the sex slavery going on with the Japanese and how they had enslaved a bunch of Korean women as prostitutes and stuff like that, and they finally had a settlement on that, and the Prime Minister of Japan finally apologized for all the egregious things they did against Korean women back in World War II.
Well, just read Rape of Nanking, and that one battle was worse than the entire five or six years of the war that the Nazis committed against the Jews. That was literally that heinous of a battle. You're talking about 8 or 9 million people in one battle. And they used biological weapons, man, and they had their entire society mobilized. 100% of the economy was going to the war machine. Even at the height of World War II, we were never over 50. So it was really, if they had resources, we would be speaking Japanese.
Yeah. Yeah, man. And, you know, and it's scary too because you know, Japan now is getting back into the theater, and that may be part of why they did what they did today in the news about with Korea. You know, Japan is now, they just passed a law about a month ago that allows them to start building up military again. And so Japan is getting ready to start joining in the American conquests around the world, and it may be in part to in our effort to contain China and Russia and all that kind of thing. I wouldn't doubt that it's happening. And now they're cracking down on the press in Japan as well. these are all things to keep an eye on. That's the end of the show, though. Thank you all for tuning in. Jake, thanks for calling in. DB, peace out, man. Anti-Media Radio, 5 days a week, same place, same time.
Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.